Hello and welcome to the Nat Coombs Show on ESPN in association with Betfred. I hope you've all had a fantastic Christmas. Certainly the football has lived up to the hype, hasn't it? What an amazing week 16. There is so much to get into. We've got to get straight down to business. And I'm delighted to say back on the show, the big man, Iron Mike. Mike, great to see you, man. What our listeners don't know is it's taken us about 47 minutes to get set for the video component of this pod with you.
Only a slight exaggeration, isn't it?
A little bit. At least Rufus is in the room, though. That's good, because we're going to let Rufus out, but he's back in, just to confirm that.
Yeah, well, that was part of the amusement, because I let him out, and he immediately came, pushed the door open behind me and came in. My bounce lighting, which I think is very Hollywood, you know, started to sink across the screen. And it was the lever you use on it, which looks like all kinds of other things that we don't need to go into. But
it's a family show.
It's a family show. Speaking of which, did you have a good Christmas?
I did, buddy. I did it. You know, like many of us, very different to the usual, but nevertheless, lots of fun for sure. And you, because we got some good questions, a bumper Mike mailbag.
Oh, good.
And some quite old school Ask Mike ones, including one about leftover turkey, which I'm looking forward to your answer on that one.
So. Oddly enough, I just finished eating lunch with leftover ham, because we had both turkey and ham in sort of smaller quantities. I think
I was about to ask you who leftover ham is. Played a couple of years back in the 80s. Right, let's get down to business. We got a ton to get into, Mike. We'll start with Sunday Night Football and another impressive performance from the Packers, and in particular Aaron Rodgers, of course, with respect to AJ Dillon as well, and that ground game going. So based on what we know right now, are they clearly the best team in football, Mike?
No, I don't think so. They're playing at a very good level, and Aaron Rodgers is showing everybody that, as I keep saying, and was saying last year, he was Patrick Mahomes before Patrick Mahomes was Patrick Mahomes. Every now and again, he tries to run just to make the point, I think, to everybody. Right. But you know, there are still very few quarterbacks who can drop a pass in the way he does, as we saw on all those passes to Devontae Adams. Nobody else had more than three targets in that game. And Devontae Adams had, what, 13? You know, they will go, obviously, as far as he goes. Their defense had a very good game plan for Tennessee, helped, I think, by the fact that Tennessee couldn't really adjust to what it was before the game, or back in Wednesday. I had actually gone along with my guys on another podcast and said, yeah, I like the Titans getting points here, because you know, I think they could stymie Green Bay.
I think a lot of people thought they would, as long as, of course, they didn't go behind too quickly, which is precisely what happened.
Yeah, and that's always the problem with them, because they really do want to be a run-first team. But then when I looked yesterday afternoon and saw snow falling in Green Bay, I went, yes, because I love football played in those conditions. And I went, oh, hang on. I told people the Titans were, because as paradoxical as it seems, with, you know, you think with Derrick Henry, you can just pound the ball out on the ground in slippery, windy conditions. But I thought it would affect their pass game a lot. I expected they'd probably run Tannehill more than they did. But I think they got out. Plus, there was an incredible turnaround in this and a couple of other games. Had these one play, and it was the blocked field goal. And up until that point, I had thought that that the Hayden Hurst pass interference call, where they called Sorensen for interfering with Hayden Hurst, when what Hurst did was actually to give him a snapmare by his head, flip him over his shoulder. And they called Sorensen for interference on that. For reasons I who could look at it and assume it was
interference? It's interesting to say that. It was obviously one of the games we were doing on radio. And at that stage, of course, lots of things happening, flying around from game to game. So I saw the flag called, and I was speculating, which way is that flag going to go? They're giving that as offense. Extraordinary. So...
yeah. Plus, of course, and then you had the one in the Colts. The Steelers got the benefit of about five consecutive interference calls or non-calls, which also perplexed me. But they had one terrible one where the ball was tipped, And they called interference when it wasn't even interference if the ball wasn't tipped. But anyway, going back to that, I thought the Hurst call was the worst call I had seen all season. Mm. And then they called the guy for offside on the block kick, on the block field goal.
And it was hold my drink.
which was, yeah. I mean, I think it was Collinsworth, you know, just sort of said, well, that's kind of borderline, you know, which means how can they call, you know, you have no line, you have the lines kind of hidden under snow. You've got the offensive blockers doing what you can do in the NFL, which is to line up your front foot with the other guy's back foot, which means that by the time you get to the tackle, you're 2 feet off the line of scrimmage, more than 2 feet. You're a yard off the line of scrimmage anyway. And this guy wasn't over the ball as far as any of the replays could show. Mm. He didn't leave early. It didn't affect the play one way or the other. And I understand that the guy would throw it. But if you're the linesman in that position, why don't you just say 46, step back?
Right. Right.
You know, and let him step back if you're worried about it that much, you know.
The trouble with that, Mike, it'd be far too commonsensical for
that's what referees used to do when I played in college, at least. And I think they often do in the pros too.
So Mike, what do we do about this? Because you're explaining it very clearly. It's inconsistent. It's erratic officiating. This is a conversation that you and I have every year. So how do you fix it? What does the NFL need to do?
Yeah. In my mind, the biggest problem is that there are rules and then there are Mike Pereira interpretations of rules, guidelines for the officials to go. And most of them are ambiguous and value judgments or judgment calls. And the problem is that not only do you have different interpretations, different points of view, literal points of view from where you're standing on the field as to what is and isn't, the key phrase now becomes unfair advantage, which I always argue is just a complete misnomer, because a receiver and a defensive back going up for a ball are not on equal terms. One has to catch the ball, the other doesn't. Mm-hmm. So that unfair advantage doesn't mean you're both guys are hand fighting. If both guys are hand fighting, it's an advantage for one guy, not the other.
And doesn't this subjectivity need to be, not every rule is black and white, right? So how do you get around that?
To an extent, it always is. But when it's programmed into the system, what you get are calls that are dependent on the result, dependent on the effect of what. And then what you get are officials making calls based on the outcome, not the process. So the official doesn't necessarily even see the process, and then throws the flag based on the outcome. And that was the one in the Indianapolis-Pittsburgh game, because the guy tripped over the trailing defensive back and he saw the outcome and threw the flag. And then they said, well, you know, he tripped, he got his foot out in front and tripped or whatever. And then Philip Rivers is on the sideline screaming, the ball was tipped, the ball was tipped. Yeah, and no one challenged it to do that. But that to me was the definition of it, is that you see the effect of the play, but you don't actually follow the play itself through. And, you know, we go through process of the catch and all that crap every year. And it really makes no difference. You know, the difference between possession and control, which is a movable feast, depending on what call you want to make. And so I just get frustrated, especially when I see them all move in one direction during a game.
All right, back to Sunday Night Football, that issue notwithstanding. So it's interesting, just to key in a bit more on the Packers, because they're in the box seat now in terms of the number one seed in the NFC. And it was another fluent performance in a game, as you rightly say, which many people thought would certainly be a lot closer than it ended up being, against an impressive Titans team, certainly an impressive Titans offense up to this game. So if you're not buying into the Packers, where are the weaklings?
Yeah, it's not that I'm buying. It's not that I'm not buying.
Let me reframe the question. If we don't buy into them,
if they were the best team in football, I don't think they're the best team in the NFC. I think the Saints are probably the best team in the NFC. Mm. But the Saints are laboring now without Michael Thomas.
Right.
So maybe they're not. Maybe the Packers have passed them. I think the Saints defense is better than the Packers defense on a more consistent basis. Mm. The game I would like to see most, I think, right now is the Packers and Seattle, because although Seattle's played very well the last 5 weeks or so. They haven't faced a quarterback who gets the ball downfield. And when they did, which was Josh Allen, they gave up 44 points and lost. Mm. So I'd like to see how they fare against Rodgers. I don't begrudge Green Bay home field advantage because I love seeing games played at Lambeau Field, especially in January and December, especially sure. when the NFL puts them on as the last game of the day at night when it's 20 degrees colder than it would have been if they played at 1 o'clock.
Let's talk more about their defense because you mentioned Tannehill. Obviously, that side of the game integral to the Titans. In terms of competing with a team like Green Bay, 11 of 24 for 121 for Tannehill, one touchdown and two picks. So he was out of sorts. How much of that was down to the Packers D and how much of that was down to Tannehill just having an off night?
A lot of it was down to the Packers D. They got... they had really good coverage. You know, they didn't miss out on anything Tennessee tried to do for the most part. And they had Savage and Jair Alexander. I think each had, you know, broke up three passes. Well, Savage had one interception, but the same thing applies. They rushed them. They basically, the only way that Tennessee was going to beat them was to run Derrick Henry, and Henry didn't have a gain over, I think it was 10 yards. Mm-hmm. And he needs to have a couple of those big bust out games. So they did a really good job on that. Mike Patton, I often think, plays guessing games with his defensive game plan and you know, tries to outguess the offense and sometimes guesses wrong. And you know, everybody does that to an extent, but he seems to do it a lot. So I just thought they had a really good game plan. And the passing game, especially in the first half, was really simple stuff, to be honest. They were sending receivers just out on sort of sideline slant routes and then bringing back down the field behind them. And to be honest, Tennessee had Derrick Henry going out of the backfield a couple of times where he was open and Tannehill didn't, you know, went to another receiver. And you would think getting Henry the ball with a little head of steam,
right,
a bit of grass, in
front, idea,
huh? Not grass, but snow in front of him would be a good idea. Yeah.
What do you make of AJ Dillon? I mean, it was a breakthrough night for him, 124 yards and two scores, but you know, clearly the future's looking bright, but what do you make of Dillon as it starts?
I liked him at Boston College. And he'd be a good fit for the Ravens, say, as well, you know, that kind of running game. So he's a perfect back for those conditions. You know, he's big, he's straight ahead runner. He's got a little bit of shiftiness to him. And, you know, when you spell Aaron Jones with him, you know, you have AJ Dillon, you have AJ Jones, you have AR, you have DA, you know, it's like the A team. So I liked him a lot. I was surprised he hadn't played more this season, but you know, they like, they like to have Aaron Jones, Jamal Williams is the as the change of pace guy.
1-2, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure I asked you this question about 11 years ago back in the Channel 5, Channel 4 days, but who was your favorite member of the A-team? Because I'm torn between whether it be Hannibal or Murdoch.
What was the woman's name?
I can't remember, mate. Okay.
I mean, you know, I pity the fool who doesn't like Mr. Oh, A.
Wait, Mr. A. Mr. A. Amazing. Yeah. All right, let's go on to the Steelers. Colts. That was an incredible turnaround for the Steelers. I mean, they look dead and buried, of course, going into that game on a real tilt, losing three on the bounce. Offense completely misfiring. There are all these stats flying around that the Steelers offense hadn't scored less than 20 points in four straight games since the 60s. And at this stage of proceedings, of course, Mike, that is not the direction you want to be trending in. And after the first half, we thought, my God, is this the Steelers season coming pretty much to an end? And then everything turned around. So what changed?
Well, I mentioned the officiating, which I think And you always hate to say this because it makes you sound like a fan with sour grapes, but I'm not a Colts fan and I'm not anti-Steelers. But I just thought the officiating made a huge difference in that second half. Mm-hmm. What Pittsburgh did right well was to go downfield for the first time in four games or whatever, you know, and once you did that, it had a beneficial effect on everything else because it forces the defense to account for people deep, you know.
Because that's been it's a really interesting point when you look at the Steelers offense this season, the last few games, not before the Colts notwithstanding, right? They have been effective, but with the short passing game primarily, right? Then people were saying Roethlisberger's arm is another one of those things, Mike, we're hearing another one of those veteran quarterbacks whose arm's gone. He doesn't have the deep ball, but that didn't seem to be the case against the Colts, certainly in the second half.
Yeah, I think they were doing that specifically because it wasn't Ben's arm. I think they were afraid their O-line couldn't protect him enough.
Right.
And with Roethlisberger, the problem is that he's going to stand there and take a beating if you can't, you know, and try to make plays and therefore make turnovers. And they don't have much of a running game, which, again, I think the O-line's just not as effective as you would expect it to be. So they decided that they would use the short pass, dink and dunk kind of offense to replace their running game and help protect Ben. And the biggest problem with that is that kind of offense, you cannot afford to make many mistakes because, you know, all of a sudden you find yourself in third and six, you know, when you pick up five on a slant or whatever. Plus the receivers were dropping just a ton of balls week in and week out. Deontay Johnson and Eric Ebron between them, you know, looked like they were trying to play basketball. You know, it's like, get that dribble, take the pass and get the dribble down first. So that was a problem. And Deontay was coming up lame in this game, you know, and partly he got a penalty because of that. But Claypool was being taken out of games when they tried to use him deep, and they managed to get him back in, I think. And I think he's going to be a really good one.
He looks the real deal. Inevitable that Juju would get in the end zone as well after the week he had. What, you must have thought that was ridiculous, Mike, the fact that he's been doing that all season long and nobody mentions it at all, or certainly doesn't mention it in any kind of negative fashion. Then the moment they lose, and there was, of course, that highlight reel play where Juju gets bossed and suddenly he is the cause, the root of all the problems with the Steelers, and he's an arrogant athlete and all of the as you would say, the talking clowns yapping away. Bleacher Report pushed this out yesterday, given the week that he had, and as I say, it annoyed me, the criticism that he had. He cleared 25K worth of layaway for Christmas gifts and essentials for 170 families last week and paid for Christmas gifts for 200 kids, Juju Smith-Schuster. So that's the kind of stuff you should be reporting about players like him, not what he's doing on TikTok before a game. Yeah. I just wanted to make that point. Hey, on to the game.
It's a good point too.
Thanks, bud. The Steelers D, because we've got to give them credit. And TJ Watt stepping up again. Two more sacks for him. He's now the sack leader in the NFL, 15 on the year. So he's got to be in that defensive MVP conversation as well. And it's worth pointing out that's against a strong Indianapolis offensive line, albeit a little bit banged up, but nevertheless, a decent offensive line. The final seven offensive possessions from the Colts, Mike. Punt, field goal, punt, 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 pick, turnover on down. So the Steelers D's got to get a lot of credit for this as well.
Yeah, they do. And Cameron Hayward, to me, is the key to that defense. And he's been noticed now. He's in all the, like, all pro projections, and he's been picked for the Pro Bowl and stuff like that. He's one of those guys who you keep saying he's underrated, you know, and then all of a sudden people start noticing him, and then it becomes like he's overrated because everybody thinks he's underrated. That's always been the base of the Steelers defense. And I was thinking about it a lot because Kevin Green died this week. And
right,
I wrote about him on my Patreon column. But, you know, the guys at the outside linebacker spots are in the glory positions because they get the sacks. But it's the three up front that are crucial to their ability to get those sacks. And and Pittsburgh can afford to often put TJ Watt in a position where the only guy who's going to block him is either a tight end or a back, which is gives him a huge advantage. You don't want not. I'm not saying anything to downgrade T.J. Watt's performance. No, sure. But you know, but that's the way the system works there. And whoever was doing that game was really whoever was the color guy on that game was really accurate in the sense that he was explaining exactly when Pittsburgh would begin to apply the blitz pressure. Mm. In the second half, you know, and at what point when the clock got to a certain point, and he was pretty accurate on it. And, you know, and they simply wound it a little bit tighter each time on each ensuing possession until you reach the point when you know that they've got to pass. And then Philip Rivers' negative points work against him because he's not the most mobile guy. You know, he's got great pocket awareness, but he's like Ben. He's not that mobile anymore. And he's willing to take a hit to make a play. And of course he made a couple of bad plays in the last quarter because he took hits as he was throwing.
Yeah, sure. And the game turn as well with his first turnover or first fumble anyway. In many a while. So the Steelers clinched the division with that. And extraordinarily, given the way the other results went, and we'll get into the playoff race now, the Colts are out of a hunt at the moment. So they're 10-5, as are the Browns, the Ravens, the Finns, and the Titans. So it is all to play for. All is not lost, certainly for Indy, but this is how it shakes out. The Finns have Buffalo in Buffalo. The Ravens are in Cincinnati. The Browns, of course, play the Steelers. And the Colts need to beat the Jags, which is highly possible. Now the Jags have locked in the number one spot, so have got nothing to play for. and hope one of those three teams loses. So it could really twist and turn in the final week of the season. I don't want to put you on the spot, Mike, because there are, I guess, a lot of different factors here, and we're recording this Monday, and injuries could play a part. But assuming there are no dramatic injuries, Cleveland-esque, where there or COVID issues, where you know an entire unit or a quarterback goes down, then who's got the toughest break there? So the Finns at Buffalo. I guess a lot depends as well on what happens with Monday Night Football.
Well, that's the problem. Is Buffalo could be sitting at 12-3 without anything really to play for,
right?
Because Kansas City's untouchable in that top seed. You can't even work with the idea that, well, I want to stay here because then I get to play Team X.
Yeah,
because
you don't know who that's going to be.
Because you don't know who that's going to be because the way of everything will play out. So
the fact if you don't have a bye, just on that, Mike, because it is interesting that obviously the number two seed doesn't get a bye anymore, right? So when you're looking at resting players, it's a great point you make where you can look at a kind of tactical, well, we'll sit these guys out for a couple of quarters or maybe the whole game because we're fine with playing it. You know, take the NFC, for example. If you're going to look at getting the five spot, so you're going to play the winner of the East, that's probably the most preferable matchup there. So you kind of get that. But as you say in the AFC, that isn't a factor. But with the lack of a bye week, a coach is going to be resting players anyway.
You've basically just anticipated what I was going to say. I always thought if you were getting a bye week, it was a bad idea to rest your players in week 17 because then now you're 2 weeks removed from actually playing, and especially when you've got a certain amount of momentum, whether or not you believe in it, but you know, going. But now without that, I think Pittsburgh in particular would be a case for resting players, you know, and Buffalo, I'm not so sure, but they wouldn't have much to lose. If you do that, Kansas City presumably is going to rest players against the Chargers, but that doesn't affect anything one way or the other. So, you know, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, if Cleveland win, they go to the playoff. So the Steelers might do it just out of spite.
Let's talk about that Cleveland game.
I'm tempted to say Cleveland's a team that's not going to make the playoffs because, you know, Baker Mayfield was reverting back to previous form against the Jets.
Are you surprised, though? I mean, given what the adversity they had to deal with, that he had a bad game. I mean,
wide receivers. I mean, you know, it was a couple of guys off the practice squad and someone who, you know, went by the stadium, in his car.
But they couldn't get the ground game going, because they were banged up on the line as well, which had an impact there. But I think that surprised a lot of people that they didn't look at Chubb or Kareem Hunt at all, right? So it was just a woeful all-round performance from the Browns, and yet they still had a shot of winning it. So whether we're getting a bit carried away with Baker's implosion there, I mean, it's not a surprise, is it?
he remains a bit unpredictable. And they need to have the weapons for him to, you know, to give him stuff. He's not really a creator in that sense.
Right.
You know, and we've seen what not having good receivers can do, you know, to quarterbacks. Although I note that Isaiah Ford, who the Patriots traded a seventh round draft pick to Miami for and then cut and then went back to Miami, and he's had two decent games in a row for the Dolphins. So, you know, it's a question of judgment. The team, I think, is in the most danger. I don't think many teams will want to play Miami because they're so good defensively. They're a tough out. Brian Flores makes them a tough out defensively. But wasn't it great that Tua got another win, you know?
well, let's talk about this. But
the team that nobody will want to play is Baltimore. And if Baltimore were to be the team eliminated from that seven, that would be a shame because they've rounded into good form now.
Really have. I mean, they are absolutely cruising right now. And on, as you say, on both sides of the ball, a formidable opponent. The Dolphins, less so, as you said, defensively amongst the strongest in the conference, but the offense is still a problem. And the quarterback situation is still a problem. This concept of bringing Fitz in as a closer, I understand the logic. It was vindicated that the call to do that. But Mike, I can't buy into this idea that Tua is fine with it. It's okay. He understands what we're doing here. It must be affecting his psyche
I don't know. I think Flores is a really good coach in a lot of ways, including management. And I think if you sit down with him and say you're still in a learning curve, and there's going to be situations where you still need to learn. And I mean, Fitz threw for twice as many yards.
Yeah.
You know, in half as many passes.
Yeah.
It wasn't like Tua was tearing things up.
No.
And, you know, and that's a very specific situation when you have, 19 seconds to get into field goal range.
Sure.
And, you know, you have a veteran quarterback who's been known for those kind of situations. You know, Fitz may not be the guy to get you through a whole season, but, you know, sometimes it is just what's the word? Willingness to put it up there when you have to comes through. And you know, would Tua have seen the open receiver? Would he have known that guy was going, was going to be there, you know, to take the pass? I don't know. And so I don't, you know, I think they will manage it okay. And Tua's the starter. I don't expect Fitz will be back unless someone else makes him an offer as a backup. I doubt if anyone's going to make, but you know, if you want to talk like what teams should do with quarterbacks, the paucity of free agent quarterbacks at the moment is outstanding.
It really is. Well, we got some tweets on that, so we'll get into. I'll dive into it and find them. But just while I'm doing that, just to follow up on the Tua thing, I get it completely. And as I say, it's vindicated, and I appreciate the situation is fundamental, and that particular situation. Very much so. But I guess the broader sense of the game's on the line, we need someone to win it. I think, yes, he's new to the NFL, but all through his playing career since Pee-wee, he's been a superstar that has been given the game to win and to lead his team. And I think in particular, a quarterback is bound to be affected by the concept of, well, we're going to hand the keys to this guy to get us over the line, even if he's a rookie.
When they did it with Tua to Jalen Hurts in the national championship game against Clemson, Hurts transferred out to Oklahoma.
Yeah. Okay.
So maybe Tua wants to transfer to Oklahoma. I mean, that's, you know, you're professionals. And I know there's a lot of coaches who wouldn't handle it well, but I really have faith in Brian Flores and his ability to handle such things well.
Yeah.
And I think Tua knows this himself. You know, it's not like he stepped in like Justin Herbert or even Joe Burrow, you know, and on a bad team thrown for 250, 300 yards every week. You know, he stepped into a pretty good team, and I wouldn't say he struggled, but he hasn't dominated for sure.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Hey, listen, you mentioned the quarterbacks, the quarterback carousel. Let's get into that because we've got some good questions on that. Andy Robson is asking about Dwayne Haskins, where he'll end up next Be very careful how you answer that one, Mike.
Yeah, there's a great place called the Golden Goose near LAX where all the basketball players used to go, apparently.
Yeah, I bet there. It sounds like a very nice restaurant, Mike. George says, do you see Matt Stafford, Matt Ryan, and Jimmy Garoppolo, of course, holding the QB1 positions at their respective teams next season? And one more for the row. You have five teams to talk about here. So Go Mad or Stop Caring asks, what do the Jets do now they've lost out on Trevor Lawrence? Has Darnold done enough for them to entertain trading
back? That I think it's one of the key questions to this whole thing, because in one sense they're like a line of dominoes that will fall.
Right.
As I said, there aren't many free agent quarterbacks available who you would want to start. Dak obviously would be the best one.
Yeah,
but
he's taking Dallas, surely.
It's hard to think Dallas will let him go one way or the other, even if they wind up franchising him. Jameis is only 26 years old. There might be a team who think that they can, you know, turn him around.
Is that assuming they're going to go with Hill then? The Saints? Assuming they're going to go with
as the backup?
Well, Drew Brees is going to retire, right?
Well, we'll see.
You almost know, suddenly.
Yeah. You would think. I don't see Jameis as being a great fit for what Sean Payton wants to do.
No.
In fact, I would say Andy Dalton might be a better fit for Sean Payton than Jameis is. Although well,
he's made his call there. I mean, he hasn't didn't give Jameis a look, right?
Not really.
That's our answer.
He had the game where he was the number two, and then they brought Taysom in. You know, you've got Joe Flacco, Tyrod Taylor, you got Rivers, who's 38, you got Fitz, who's 38, you got Nate Sudfeld's a name to watch, because he hasn't played enough to turn anybody off.
I think you're winding me up, Nate Sudfeld. I'm going to clip that one up and bring it
from the Eagles.
No, you know,
no. The third guy on the Eagles.
Peterman's a name to watch. Daniel's a name to watch.
Nate Peterman's going to be a free agent, by the way.
Of course.
Dalton, I think, will probably have some offers because he's done well. And Cam Newton might.
All right.
He's only 31, which in football terms, quarterback terms, is an old. Blaine Gabbert has looked okay too when he's played.
Good when he came in, yeah.
Yeah, but he's 31 as well. So then the question is,
they're all backups, really.
None of those guys who you mentioned, who Roger Sherman mentioned, have backups who can come in and start.
Mm. So
Detroit,
this is Stafford, Ryan, and Jimmy.
Yeah. The Niners could try to get through with Nick Mullins or CJ Beathard, who's also a free agent, next year if they had to, but they don't want to, obviously. I don't know why you would think they would move away from Jimmy G, apart from his brittleness, his injury.
Is that the only reason, though? Or did they
Well, he got them to the Super Bowl last year, and my argument is always that if he hadn't been concussed by that hit from Neiman, it wasn't called, they might have done a little bit better.
Well, I guess the critics say, they didn't, he didn't make that critical play, and that's the difference. You've got a Kirk Cousins level quarterback that will keep you competitive in the regular season, get you to the playoffs, and maybe you can get it to think. But
that's fair enough. And Cousins is probably a pretty good comparison. But he's also a guy who can run in the structure of Kyle Shanahan's offense, probably better than Kirk Cousins could. I can't see them being in a hurry to move away from those guys, because the plan B isn't there. Looking at the draft, Lawrence obviously is going to go to the Jags, and he will probably pretty obviously be the starter from day one, which is a bad situation for him, depending on what happens with Jacksonville's draft and who they bring in as coach, assuming they move away from Doug Marrone, whose success with quarterbacks is already well documented.
On that, Mike, with the Jags locking down Trevor Lawrence, that automatically makes Jacksonville as a potential landing spot all the more attractive for the very, very top candidates, doesn't it? Who might not have looked at the gig before. Because they're going to have Lawrence. So if somebody like Bieniemy, for example, thinks I can go and work with this generation.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point, especially for an offensive-minded coordinator. I think Jacksonville will have to avoid a defensive-minded coordinator unless he brings along or makes them hire someone you could trust with the development of an extremely talented quarterback. And
right.
I like Lawrence better than either Herbert or Burrow coming out of college. Mm. I think he's got all the tools. I don't see an easy pick as a number two guy in this draft. I'm not convinced by Fields. Mm. I haven't looked at it, you know, in great detail, but from everything I've seen, both before and after trade, he's somewhere between sort of Jalen Hurts and Jake Fromm. I don't see him as an automatic top of the first round kind of guy. Last year, I thought Trey Lance was that guy, but Lance hasn't played this year, and he played the year before at North Dakota State in his only year, and that's a huge jump, as we've seen, you know, with Carson Wentz, who had a much better portfolio behind him. I thought last year that Lance might be better than Wentz, and he still might be, but we don't have anything to go by based on this year, and, you know, and going through the rest of the, there aren't that many other candidates who you could expect to even play their rookie year, much less step in as a starter. So you're really talking about only a few people available for those quarterback needs.
Yeah.
And none of them are immediately preferable to Matt Stafford, apart maybe from Dak. Mm. You know, Matt Ryan, same deal. So what are you going to do? I think someone wrote one of the questions we had was, you know, do you draft a guy to develop? And I think that's exactly what you do. Mm. And you know, you might be able to get a guy in the end of the first round, like Lance, say, or in the second or third rounds, who you can develop into a player. But you know, the hit rate on first round quarterbacks is not that much greater than the hit rate on developmental guys in the second, third rounds, you know.
It's a good point. The Christian Ponder effect, as they call it in some parts. But Mike, on this, and specifically on the Jets, and that was Go Mad or Stop Caring's tweet about Darnold. It was interesting to note that when the Jets won and the cameras were going up and down the sideline showing how much it meant to the players, Sam Darnold was the most vocal. Yeah, no surprise there. But yeah. two points on this.
The worst thing they could do is keep Adam Gase.
Well, I was going to say, but hear me out for a minute, because I'm by no means suggesting they're going to do this. But when we see a team with a losing record and an abject season, one of the things we often hear is, well, they might be losing, but the team's really playing for, insert coach's name here. But surely, whatever you think of Gase, what we've seen over the last 2 weeks and the reaction to that win yesterday shows that they're playing for something.
You're a Dolphins super fan, right?
Right.
When the Patriots lost on the last second play, the Miami Miracle. Did that make you want them to keep Adam Gase as the coach?
Fair, but it's
they were
more
playing
than just
hard.
That, more
they
than
were
just
playing hard. They got the big upset win.
Yeah, it's a fair point, I guess. But no one's making. I guess the ship has sailed, and too much damage has been done by Gase both on and off the field. But no one's making the point that, hey, well, the Jets are balling at the moment in terms of, you know, a team that is obviously lackluster in terms of talent, has put together two wins and is passionate, right?
It's going to be interesting because this is presumably a Joe Douglas decision. And Joe Douglas might well think Gase is okay. You know, he may well think that he and Gase together can rebuild the team. There is some talent on the Jets. Mm. They still have a few good players on the defense. You saw Joe Douglas was willing to let Jamal Adams go, you know, and pick up for that. They have draft picks. They've got a lot of cap space. So I always think, and it depends not on whether you think Sam Darnold is going to be better than Trevor Lawrence or whatever. And I keep going back to that quarterback draft and saying it's weird how all those guys continue to be the guys we thought they were coming out of college. They've lived up to their scouting reports, apart from Josh Allen now, who has clearly moved a step beyond what he did in college. He's learned a bit how to throw with more accuracy and but Darnold was a guy who would make big plays and make bonehead errors.
Yeah.
And it's still the he's still the same guy, you know, who didn't necessarily see everything really well at USC, but you know, but could make those big plays. And
Mike, let me ask you something on that. If you mentioned situation is critical, of course, and Trevor Lawrence is going to go into an opportunity, great one, if he indeed lands in Jacksonville. But yeah, if Darnold had gone to a more competitive team, say Darnold had gone to a Miami type situation, for example, you know, where they were a contender, certainly not a woeful team, would his trajectory have been similar, or do you think he that stability would have made
that was the point I was building up to, I think, was that you have to decide what his overall utility is and then whether you're better off sticking with him and building a team around him that can get the best out of him. You know, build an offensive line that will protect him so that he's not throwing in panic all the time. Build an offensive line that will give him time to throw so your receivers can take the pressure off him. Your running game can take the pressure off him. Build a defense that means you're not chasing 21-point leads all the time and having to throw. And that's a philosophy that, you know, a number of teams have, okay, our guy's good, you know, he's not world beating, but we can win a Super Bowl. If you have a really great defense, you can win it with Brad Johnson or Joe Flacco. Trent Dilfer.
Or Jared Goff, right? I mean, this is.
Yeah. You know. Or Jared Goff. And I think Darnold's upside, it's consistency. I was going to say, you know, you mentioned Kirk Cousins before. Mm. He could be a Kirk Cousins if he could just become a little more consistent. And you know, can you get to a Super Bowl with Kirk Cousins? You probably can. You know, I think the Vikings came pretty close to it a couple of years ago.
Right.
But do you want to spend $80 million on him to do that? Sure. No.
Well, this is what the Rams have done. Let's get to that and the Seattle Rams situation, because, or rather, the Rams situation after the defeat to Seattle, because the Seattle Seahawks have clinched the division with that win. Jared Goff, who was getting vilified for his performance, it transpires that he dislocated his thumb and had it pop back in.
Does that word come from Aston Villa supporters?
Quite conceivably, yeah. The Goff situation is interesting because it looks like he won't play in week 17. They're certainly suggesting that he's doubtful, right? And they are right in the mix right now. So looking at the playoff picture here, the Rams fall to 9-6.
It's a win and in for them in Arizona. They're 9-6. Arizona's 8-7.
Yeah, exactly. So they beat the Cardinals. They're in, but they could also get in the Rams if they can lose to Arizona and the Bears win. So if the Packers beat the Bears, the Rams will still get in. That's right. Yep.
So the Bears would be 8-8. However, the Bears, if the Rams win and the Bears win, the Bears will get in at 8-8.
Exactly right. Yeah, that's it. So
you'll have the team from the NFC East at 7-9 at the best.
Yeah.
That's the best. And the Bears at 8-8, both in the playoffs. It's great. Let's add another team to the playoffs.
Let's talk about the Seahawks defense, because that's been hammered for much of the season, but it's starting to, you know, credit where credit's due. Right?
Well, I mentioned that before, you know, because they haven't faced a downfield thrower of any note. And to me, the thing was, Jamal Adams had to adjust to what they play, and he learned it really quickly. But he still is somewhat of a liability deep. And especially when you don't have an Earl Thomas as your one deep safety. He's in the Cam Chancellor role, you know, basically. Quandre Diggs, I guess, is the most of the time the single deep, who's good. But they're not being, if you can't threaten them downfield, Adams can play up near the line of scrimmage and he gets his sacks. He's like a fourth linebacker, which is what you want in that system. And he's played well. I mean, you know, he's been worth the price that they paid, I would say. So the question's when they play someone with a good downfield passing game. They split the season with the Rams, but they held them to 23 or 27, I think, in the game they lost. It wasn't like the Rams went crazy on them. So, you know, that's why I'd love to see them play the Packers.
Right.
In the playoffs, because I think that would be a really great matchup.
Because the rest of the playoff teams have been looking at it. There aren't, I mean, okay, Brady, I think, has shut those critics up to suggest he doesn't have a downfield arm anymore. Yeah. And obviously Arians likes to go that direction. But the rest of them, you know, the Saints, that's not how they're built. Washington, similarly, right? And the Bears, you know, it's so it really is that will be the mismatch as far as Seattle, because as you rightly say, against Aaron Rodgers and Devontae Adams and the Packers. What about the Seahawks offensive line, Mike? Because that's a big problem, isn't it?
Yeah, and somewhat less so than it was, you know, previously. But they want to be a running team. Mm. They want, you know, they're not even as concerned with pass pro as they probably should be, because they know Russell Wilson can keep plays alive on his own, even if the line collapses. So
Right. They
wanted to build a run blocking line. There were a couple of plays where Chris Carson looked like the Chris Carson of old this weekend. But and with DK Metcalf, Wilson's got a target that he doesn't have to necessarily place the ball in perfectly each time, which is, you know, the perfect thing for a guy who's throwing on the run a lot. So, you know, offensively, I think they can keep themselves. The old formula was keep the game close with defense, and then Russ will win it for us in the last seven minutes. Now I think they can actually keep themselves ahead in games, make the other team. And that's what Pete Carroll loves as a defensive coach. Is like most defensive coaches, he wants to be at a place where he can tee off on you with pass rush and coverage. To me, the interesting thing is whether, well, there's kind of like two questions, is whether Green Bay rest against the Bears, which I don't think they should do because they've got the week off anyway afterwards. And then whether the Rams start Woodford, who was the second best quarterback in the AAF, the Alliance of American Football.
Oh, did he play in there? Okay.
Yeah. I mean, Garrett Gilbert was the best. And
Garrett
he was
Gilbert,
second
yeah,
best.
Yeah.
So, he's not, you know, he's legitimately an NFL backup, say. Mm. He lacks a big arm. He's not very big himself.
He's Taylor Heineke-esque, is what you're saying.
Heineke lacks an arm.
Okay. He looked pretty good last night, though, nevertheless.
Yeah. I mean, he's a heady kid, but it wasn't until I actually watched him play at the upper level, I realized just how bad his arm was.
So let's look at this playoff picture in the NFC, Mike. I mean, the Bears got a wound up our friend Ben Isaacs this morning because Adam Schefter was reporting that it looks like both Matt Nagy and Mitchell Trubisky are going to be at Soldier Field for another year, particularly if they make the playoffs, right? So it is bittersweet because most Bears fans want to see the back of both of them.
Yeah, but it's been interesting watching them the last couple of weeks because they are sort of doing what you would have thought they would have been doing from the start with Mitch Trubisky. Mm. He's become a kind of rollout quarterback, a lot of play action, a few run pass option kind of plays, but a lot of rolling out, you know, just getting out of the pocket, trying to force defenders to commit in the middle ground and then just lofting balls over them and stuff. So I you know, it's taken a long time to get there, but I admire the effort that, you know, that they've put in to do that. I agree again, but you go back to that same situation, the devil you know against the devil you don't,
right?
You know, if you get rid of Nagy, do you have to get rid of Trubisky as well, or vice versa? If you get rid of Trubisky and keep him, who does he coach? You know, is Nick Foles your quarterback? No, we already know that. As someone pointed out the interesting thing about the quarterbacks who have beaten Brady in Super Bowls and how they're a relatively unimpressive list, whereas the best quarterbacks that he's faced have lost to him.
Eli notwithstanding, though, right? Because he's going to the Hall of Fame, right?
We don't want to have that discussion now.
It's Christmas. Come on.
In the current issue of Gridiron, which is a really good Christmas issue, and I did a couple of pieces on families in football.
Families.
Yeah, you know, father, son, brother combinations and stuff like that. The guy who does the sort of statistical analysis did a Hall of Fame breakdown and said Eli's an utter certainty to get into the Hall of Fame.
I'm with you.
And that, yeah, I wrote the editor a letter saying, do you want my next column?
Oh, boy. So the Bears, so let's have a look at this playoff picture then. The Bucks have clinched a playoff berth, whatever happens, right, at 10-5. So the Rams, as you
say. I think they're locked into the fifth seed.
They're locked. Oh, it's the fifth as well, which is.
I read that somewhere. I'm not sure if it's correct.
Good news for them, because that means, of course, they'll play the winner of the NFC East. Who's going to be who, Mike? Are the Cowboys looking the best bet now?
Yeah, it's funny. If Philadelphia could have just won one more game, The scenario would have been great, because if they had beaten Washington, then they would have finished like 6-9-1, and everybody else would have finished 6-10. And it would have Iron Mike's law of ties being the best tiebreaker would have applied. But Philadelphia is the only team out of it. I guess what it boils down to is Washington, if they win, go in. And if they don't, then the winner of the Giant Dallas game will go in at 6-10. I think that's correct. I don't think either of those teams hold a tiebreaker over WTF, but I think Washington deserve it in a sense. And I guess I'd rank them Washington, Dallas, and then New York in terms of deserviosity for the way they're playing now. I think Ron Rivera has done a pretty good job based on what he's got there. They obviously have to work out the quarterback situation. I think Joe Judge has done a good job in New York, which doesn't have a whole lot of talent on the offensive side of the ball. Daniel Jones remains another one of these guys who's,
what are you going to do?
What he was when he came out of college.
Are they going to stay with him for another year?
I think they have to be honest. It's just, how do you teach a guy pocket presence, And that's one of the questions I have with like Fields, with Jalen Hurts. Say, some guys have it, but when you play in these college offenses that make your reads simple, and if that read's not there, you take off, you don't get that sense of awareness. And some of the guys who are less mobile learn it by default, because you have to. And if they're really good, they learn to take the one or two steps in the pocket that keep them clean and get the throw away, as opposed to scrambling. But the ones who don't learn it wind up getting killed in the pocket. It's a difficult process there. And, we had a question from someone asking, is Dan Snyder the...
Yes, I was about to go to... Yeah, I was going to wrap things up with the mailbag. So there are three questions that I haven't touched on yet that I'm going to get into. A couple of football... and one old school Ask Mike at the end as well, which we got a reboot.
You promoted that at the top of the show.
I gave a little taster for that one. No pun intended. So Joshua Edwards, hey Joshua, says, is Dan Snyder the worst owner this century?
That's a low bar. This right. century at least narrows it down, because you really got some winners from the last century.
Right.
But in this, the problem with the thing with Dan Snyder is that he's actually stayed away from the team to a pretty good extent. Now the other side of that was he had Bruce Allen in charge for far too long, and let Bruce Allen force out people who were more talented than himself from their front office. His competition would probably be Jimmy Haslam, who also has kept a low profile in terms of interfering with the team lately, and also had lots of problems. And then some of the legacy boys, Jim Irsay with the Colts, again, left the team to the GM, has kept a low profile. Mark Davis with the Raiders. I particularly dislike guys who move their teams to places where they probably shouldn't move them.
Well, even Vegas, Mike? Come on.
what's this? Dean Spanos, the latest Spanos in San Diego, moved the team to... And what you get generally is you get this long kind of consistent mediocrity. Not necessarily bad, but not necessarily very good. I mean, Woody Johnson, you got with the Jets, who was inflicted on this country as ambassador for a couple of years, which didn't seem to affect the Jets one way or the other. Jed York I think you might. And then there's Mike Brown. And Mike Brown's the most interesting case because Mike Brown's the one who inherited the team, obviously, from his father, but is the only owner in the NFL who continues to run the team as his means of making a living. He and the entire family. It's a family operation, which is like the old days. So I'm hesitant to put him in the same category, although you could argue that the priority has always been to keep making a living at the expense of the product put on the field. And they, you know, for him, the ideal situation were those years with Marvin Davis, where he could put a competitive team out every year that would dive in the first round of the playoffs. And, you know, and it always, it kept the hope there for the fan base.
Sold some jerseys off the back of it, but yeah.
Yeah, but you didn't have to spend big. Marvin Lewis was very, very good at putting together a team without any, you know, without a whole lot of money behind it.
Such a good point. I think, remember, for years, it was, if not the lowest, and always sort of bottom three lowest budgets in the NFL, and yet they were competitive. I mean, he had Carson Palmer for a lot of that, right? And TJ and Chad. Yeah.
And then you saw, that's when you saw the real reality of the situation was when they let Carson Palmer go.
Yeah.
You know, refused to play him.
Refused to pay him,
because he wouldn't, you know. And, crazy. Yeah.
Okay, good stuff, Mike. Thanks for that question, Joshua. Here's one from the 5 Yard Rush crew. Shout out to them. Does Doug Peterson survive in Philly after going 13-18 and, of course, that one since the Super Bowl?
That's a really good question because there will be an awful lot of sentiment, I think, in the ownership to keep him because he did do a good job there. But there'll be an awful lot of sentiment to get rid of him in Philadelphia where the sports media is probably the most vicious in the country. And there'll be, I think in the middle ground, there'll be people saying, well, without Frank Reich there, he's not the offensive mind people thought he was. Reich is, I think, almost indisputably a more creative offensive guy who's been able to work with the parts that he has better. And, it would be an interesting thing to see if they let Carson Wentz, if Indianapolis would become interested in Carson Wentz based on Reich's time with Carson Wentz. The problem being he carries a huge salary cap hit next year. And it's going to make it hard to trade, but not impossible. And then what do you do with Philip Rivers? He's only on a 1 year contract.
It's a 1 year gig, isn't it? Yeah. That is a fascinating idea, actually. Wentz going.
But yeah, I think Peterson's probably gone. But there will be a lot of people who point to the Eagles' injuries, which basically the Eagles are an injury nightmare every year.
Yeah.
As bad as any team in the NFL, I think. So maybe the strength and conditioning coach. Well, you know, it's also a factor of having a lot of old higher priced guys on the offensive line that you don't want to move on from because they're really good players, but at some point you have to.
Yeah, sure. And you know, DeSean Jackson, I mean, and what a play he had last night.
But that's been DeSean for the last, you know, DeSean's a one play guy nowadays.
Yeah, right. And unfortunately injured for most of the rest of it. All right, one for the road, Mike. And this is the Ask Mike reboot from the Light Night. Appreciate this.
Late night.
The most important question that is being asked on this podcast, Mike, just to be clear, what's the best way to use leftover turkey? Is it sandwiches, curry, or something else?
There's no best way, grasshopper. The way to use the bird is all of those and more. That's what makes turkey so good. Turkey is so flexible because it doesn't dominate anything. You can do with it what you want. I always would make a turkey curry. I'd probably wind up making a turkey stir fry, you know, at some point.
We'll go to the Carlson turkey sandwich.
You need to make turkey soup.
Oh, turkey soup. Nice.
Yeah. You need to make stock from the turkey and make turkey soup. And the sandwich is the best meal. You know, Christmas is leftovers, right? So it's basically the Christmas it's kind of like the Alliance of American Football version of of Christmas dinner. You know, it's the leftover turkey, some mashed potatoes here, some turnips there, you know, some beans, gravy. You pour the gravy all over everything and then you eat it all down. But the next meal, which is the turkey sandwich, is actually the best meal
possible. Of the whole run.
Competes with Christmas dinner or Thanksgiving dinner itself. And that's the, you need good bread for it. And something chewy, sourdough bread, ciabatta, a stone baked kind of baguette, you know, all that kind of stuff. And you have turkey.
That helps, right?
You have the mayo. Yeah. You have the mayo and cranberry sauce, which would be unthinkable when you're having the turkey itself. Stuffing. Mm-hmm. You need to have stuffing on it, especially if you put celery in your stuffing, so it gives it some crunch. And then maybe some mashed potatoes if they're left over. Maybe a
big sandwich.
Sliced tomatoes. Yeah, it's a big sandwich. You know, you get your fattest relative to sit on it. putting a cutting board between them and the sandwich. So you're not
either, naturally. Yeah, but of course.
To protect both sandwich and trousers. And that's it. And that's gravy. And then you gravy it, you know. So the question is whether you eat it like this or whether you do it kind of like an open sandwich, you know, with the gravy poured over it.
You got to cram it in, and you got to tuck the napkin in, into the top collar, and just have that out.
What else is
your bib, Mike?
Another good one is a turkey melt, where you melt the cheese on top of the turkey in a sandwich.
You're making me hungry. We're recording this at lunchtime.
Throw some onions in there.
You sold me on that. You missed. I said, Mike, you could wear your bib, and you just rolled. Don't pretend you don't have a bib, Mike. Come on,
Mustache Pete. Yeah, I was watching. For some reason, I was watching the scene in The Godfather where where Michael kills Sollozzo and Sterling Hayden. I'm trying to remember. I can't remember what his name is. The corrupt police captain. And the best part of that scene is the way Sterling Hayden concentrates completely on what he's eating. And has the napkin stuffed in his
front of his.
And when he's shot, it's like the napkin of sorts. It's so good.
Oh, it's brilliant.
When you gotta go, you gotta go.
I don't know if I'm misremembering the you know, Sopranos episode where they go over to Italy, and I don't know if I'm just imagining whether Paulie tucks his napkin in the same way, but he definitely says at one point, "Where's the gravy?" when they're getting the pasta, the Italians just look at him in disbelief.
There's a good video. Let me recommend while we're on the culinary subject, and this
let's
was
do it.
Ollie, right. Ollie will cut it, I'm sure, but we can if he does, we can bring it up next week.
No, definitely no pun intended.
There's a great video of some Italian woman making bolognese sauce outdoors with what looks like a bucket that has a flame in it, and using that as the stove. And it is actually the best spaghetti sauce recipe I've seen.
You followed the recipe.
I followed it. It worked beautifully the first time. And I'm not a big bolognese fan anyway. But I've done it with eggplant. I've done it with sausages. And it's just the base sauce. You'll see it's quite a simple idea. But I always put carrots in my
spaghetti. I'm with you on that.
Spaghetti sauce. But she cooks them in right away.
Uh-huh.
And she makes a really thick mess, which is then only lightened at the end with the pasta water. And it works fantastically. And then you stir the pasta into the sauce.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And it sticks to the pasta brilliantly. It's fantastic. Well, so anyway, if you Google like old Italian woman making sauce for her mother, she's about 90 years old. And she's
very careful what you Google. I think what we will do there is get the link from you and Mike, plus, and we'll push that
Google
out.
Google old Italian woman making sauce plus Dwayne Haskins.
The best bit about that story was when I said, oh, have you tried it? And he said, yeah, yeah, it was good. I mean, the first time.
The first time was the best. I mean, I followed it precisely the first time.
The second time was never as good.
It was the best. And I also had some really good pasta. That's when you discover that the quality of the pasta can make a difference. Mm. When the sauce is sticking to the pasta as opposed to just being dumped on top of it, like from a dump truck.
Cooking with Carlson is a new podcast we are working on.
You know what? I think this. I've already had that idea. You know,
in the last
3 minutes. The only thing I couldn't do is that Nigella stuff of doing like erotic gestures with spoons that have flour on.
God, you don't want to go there, Mike. Otherwise, I'd have been off that trade straight away. But I like it. It's got legs. The idea has legs. So we'll work on that. Patreon.com/ Mike Carlson FMT is your latest column. You mentioned you wrote about Kevin Green, of course, and lots of other good stuff up there right now.
Yeah, and you know what?
What was that? For the benefit
The column's not the only thing that's got legs here.
Oh, I see. For the benefit of our pod listeners, Mike just showed a bit of ankle, very risque, from Mike at Christmas.
You won't see that from Nigella.
Great stuff, bud. Cracking work as ever. Look after yourself. Happy Christmas. Happy New Year as
well. Have a good New Year. Yeah.
We'll see you in 21.
A nice lockdown New Year.
Look after yourself.
Yep. You too, mate.
Lovely stuff from Iron Mike. He'll be back in 2021. You can count on it. We're going to be back later on this week. Our Edge Rush show, me and producer Ollie, getting a set for week 17, the best action to be had. We've been on a roll, quite frankly, although we're not going to mention the Cleveland Browns scuppering what would have been 5 in a row for our Acura of the week, our Moneyline Treble of the week. Hey, you can't win them all. Then the breaks. But generally, that's been good. So if that's your thing, then check out the Edge Rush show and the regular show back with Ben Isaacs later on this week. Our week 17 preview dropping in a couple of days. So the content coming thick and fast, as it is on our social channels as well, at the NC Show, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. So pick your poison there as well. Lots of extra video content gets pushed out on there. And incidentally, for all of those who have left a review on whichever pod platform you listen to us on, Apple Podcasts or whatever, we massively appreciate that. Really, really appreciate you taking the time to do that. It puts a big smile on our face. And if you haven't and you like the show and you got a spare 30 seconds, minute, that would be great if you could do that, because it helps us with ESPN, with our sponsors, Betfred, and most importantly of all, puts a big smile on the faces of producer Ollie and producer Marley. And that's important at this time of year. It is the season of goodwill, of giving and sharing, right? So thanks for all of you who've done that. And if you have time, we would appreciate that. We'll be back with Edge Rush and with the Week 17 preview later on this week. Bye for now, guys.